Good evening, everyone. Thank you for your grace. We've been having a little bit of a reunion in this room already, and it's been so much fun. So I'm Carolyn Crockett. I am a co-chair along with Lou Finfer of the Boston Desegregation and Busing Initiative. And so I have a really short and easy function, which is really to welcome you and to get out of the way so that you guys can hear and receive the main event. So first of all, again, welcome to Roxbury Community College. We are so delighted to be in this historic and important educational institution in the heart of the city, in the heart of Roxbury. We are here tonight representing an initiative that has pulled together itself to bring into focus a conversation about the 50th anniversary of the effort to desegregate Boston schools in 1974. So any of you that knows math or can count knows that the 50th milestone year is next year, 2024. But we have started and kicked off a series of events beginning this year to get us all ready. So for tonight, you're here for this forum, which is the first in a series of five events that the Boston Desegregation and Busing Initiative has been meeting and planning and talking about for about a year. So the initiative represents about 50 leaders, people who have firsthand experience in this history, people who were teachers, who were kids on the bus, who were elected officials, appointed people, people who were all involved in this story in the 1970s and before. My story is that my grandmother was one of the original plaintiffs. Mary Crockett was one of the parent plaintiffs alongside of Tallulah Morgan, who came together to sue the Boston School Committee because of its inability and unwillingness to bring quality education to black and white children across the city. So I'm here representing a multi-generational vision for what can happen. Thank you for being here and standing with us. Tonight is an important beginning for all of us to recognize that the history that we embody, that the history that we're talking about is not just history. This initiative is about thinking about what has happened, what are the lessons learned, and what we must do next. We are excited to join together with you on this panel and to recognize our partners, the Massachusetts Historical Society, whose staff is in the room. We're delighted to have them with us. We could not do this event without the Massachusetts Historical Society. We also could not do this event without GBH. These partners have been essential for us being able to bring this content to you and to share. So tonight, this forum is being recorded with the help of GBH, so that we can send out a recording to all of those people that had hoped to live stream the event with us this evening. We apologize that technical difficulties meant that we're not able to live stream, but we are excited to be able to share a recording in the days ahead. I would also just pause now and hope that you can help me welcome the president of Roxbury Community College, President Jackie Jenkins Scott, to give us a welcome address. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for being with us. Carolyn, I have to give you one small correction. I am the interim president of Roxbury Community College, and it is my great honor to serve in that role because this is such an incredibly amazing, phenomenal institution, and we are just so pleased that you chose to be here tonight for this important event. Many of you know that we are celebrating our 50th anniversary this year in 2023. That 50th anniversary could not have happened without the work of organizing for a better education in Boston. The work that happened from 1960 to 1973 allowed Roxbury Community College to be, to exist, and for that we are grateful. We have survived and thrived up and down over 50 years I want to just take one quick moment, if I may, Carolyn. I know we have an incredible program, and I don't want to hold us too long. But at the beginning of this year, we honored 49 people who impacted Roxbury Community College, who made it possible for us to exist today. And two of them are sitting on the stage. So I think we have to, I just want to give honor and thank you and gratitude to Hubie Jones and Gene McGuire for they are our leaders. This institution would not exist without them, and so we're so grateful to have them with us and to have you with us this evening. So I want to just do the duty, which is to say thank you and welcome. And I will turn it back to Carolyn.
And I stand by my introduction of President Jackie Jenkins Scott. Thank you so much for being here and leading us so ably. We have an incredible program for you tonight and an incredibly distinguished panel. And so you see to my left a bunch of people that many of you know, and maybe some new faces and some stories that maybe you haven't heard before, but a real opportunity for us to sit inside of what is an incredibly important set of stories and histories that remain for that remain to be reckoned with, received, honored, and respected. We welcome you into a conversation that will be full and rich and maybe at some times difficult and traumatic for people, but we are standing here inside of a loving and respectful community space. We are honored to have none other than Mayor Kim Janey moderating this panel. Mayor Janey, of course, needs no true introduction, aside from all of you knowing that she is a daughter of this city, a daughter of the streets of Roxbury, of the South End, of the entire city, and lives its educational history, promise, and its incredibly fiery commitment to justice and equity from the day she was born until now. It is an absolute honor to have her moderate for us, and I welcome Mayor Janey to the microphone.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I am just so excited to be here this evening, and we certainly have a treat for you. I want to begin with gratitude. I want to thank Lou and Carolyn and the entire committee for all of the work that they have done and will continue to do to lift up these stories. I want to thank our president for lending RCC as a meeting space for the community, and all of you for being here. I am blessed to moderate a wonderful conversation, not only as a former elected official, but as someone who was bused as a kid. And I have deep gratitude for the folks in this room. I have the honor of being on stage with living legends here and folks who were in that fight. So I am just blessed and honored to be here this evening. I want to tell you a little bit about our format, then I'm going to introduce our guest speakers tonight so that we can just get into it. So for the format, we're gonna start off by hearing from one of our panelists who will share some insights from his new book. Then we're gonna go into a fireside chat with a couple of our living legends here. We're gonna see some video clips, and then we're gonna just open it up for a panel discussion, and we hope to have time. So I'm gonna look at the panelists. We hope to have time to invite audience participation. Is that okay with everyone? You guys sure? All right, so I'm gonna introduce our esteemed panelists in the order that you will hear from them. So I'm gonna start with Zeb Maletsky, who is a PhD and an associate professor at the Department of Africana Studies and History at Stony Brook University. And his book, this is the book we're gonna hear about, today is Before Busing, A History of Boston's Long Black Freedom Struggle. And it was published by the University of North Carolina Press, December of 2022. He grew up here in Boston in JP, and he is a graduate of the Boston Public Schools. Give it up for Zeb, please. Next, You will hear from Hubie Jones, who needs no introduction, but he was a leader in the desegregation efforts in the 1960s and the 1970s. He organized an economic boycott on June 26. He did a lot in terms of METCO and the early days of METCO and getting suburbs to step up to the plate. He is the founder of an organization that I worked for many years, Mass Advocates for Children, so I have to lift that up. We are thrilled to have you here, Hubie. You've done so much since then, Boston's Children's Corps, Higher Ground. We are all grateful and benefit from your work. Please recognize Hubie. We'll keep the applause brief so that we can move through intros. Next, we will hear from Jean McGuire, my shero. Yes, my shero. Give it up for Jean McGuire. She's a longtime director of METCO, one of the co-founders. She served in leadership there from 1973 to 2016. She was a teacher, and she was on the front lines. And she is also a history maker as the first black woman to be elected to the Boston School Committee, serving from 1982 to 1992. Please give it up for Jean. And then we will hear from Lyda Peters. She was active in organizing in the 60s and the 70s, and she worked very closely with Ruth Batson. She has 45 years as an educator, I believe in BPS, and as a community activist. We are grateful for all of the work that you have done, Lyda. Thank you so much for being here. We will also hear from Reverend Charlie. I think we call you Charlie. Is that okay? We will hear from Charlie. He was the superintendent at the Freedom School, the stay-out school at Roxbury Crossing Church. He's done so much in our city, and I can't wait to hear from Charlie. We are also joined by Gloria Lee, who participated in a Freedom Stay Out in 1963, which was held at 12th Baptist Church. That is my home church, my family church. She was a teacher at New School for Children, school that I went to. And I'm so glad that we have this rich, rich panel to dig in, because the stories that are often told in the media talk about the court order, and they talk about busing, and they talk about white resistance. What they don't talk about is the work that led up to that, and that is the organizing work and the work especially of black women in our city, black mothers, black aunties, grandmothers who were on the front lines to protect black children and to make sure that black children got a better education. That is a story that is not told. So I'm really grateful for this opportunity to have that discussion today. Are we ready to get into it? Yes. A round of applause for our wonderful, esteemed panel. All right. As we jump in, we are first going to hear from Zeb Malitsky, who is going to share some key learnings from his book, and then we will do the fireside chat with Hubie and Jean. Zeb? And we're on a tight time schedule. I want to remind all of the speakers here. Is that on? The button's right on top. You see it? There it is.
How about that? Okay.
There you go.
All right. Thank you so much. What an honor to be here and sitting among true legends, people who I've written about in the book, and it's just an honor to meet them in person. In order to truly understand the school desegregation struggle in Boston, in my humble opinion, we have to go to a court case not in the 20th century, but in the 19th century. The case involved Benjamin Roberts' five-year-old daughter, Sarah Roberts, mm-hmm. who attended the underfunded Abel Smith Common School for Black Children, which was located at a great distance from the Roberts' home. In response, Roberts' father attempted to enroll his daughter in a whites-only school closer to their home and was denied, leading to the lawsuit that sought to end racial discrimination in Boston public schools in the 19th century. The fact that a first grader had to pass directly by five primary schools to get to the Smith School on Belknap Street in the West End was extreme. Roberts made no less than 4 separate attempts to enroll Sarah in one of the other public schools closer to home, but her application was rejected every time. It was but one example of the many travails that Black children had to undergo in the Boston system. That this case spoke for many Black parents and their children is what made it so important. But because it was not a class action suit, the Roberts faced the judge alone. And in 1850, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court found not in favor of the Roberts, but in favor of the city of Boston, claiming no constitutional basis for the suit. The U.S. Supreme Court later cited this case in its infamous 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision. And although they did not use the term separate but equal, it was a case not in Mississippi, not in South Carolina, but up here in liberal Boston that was the template for separate but equal in the nation. And so my book looks at before busing, and by doing so, tries to put some of this in context. As you already heard, the year 2022 marked 50 years since 14 Black parents and 44 children in Boston found the courage to file another lawsuit with the help of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People against the city of Boston and federal district court contesting school segregation. Unlike the somewhat inauspicious anniversary of the resulting court order in 1974, I argue in the book perhaps a better case can be made for the recognition of 1972 as a year worthy of recognition. After all, it is hardly worth celebrating an anniversary that so many people found to be painful. Bostonians suffer from an incomplete story. How many of us know that in 1972, Black parents in Boston enlisted the help of lawyers from the Harvard University Center for Law and Education, including a young Tom Atkins, who was a student at Harvard Law School, to sue the city's school committee, arguing that Boston was maintaining 2 separate school systems. This is a much different narrative from the one that has dominated over the last 50 years. Like all Bostonians, these parents paid local taxes and were entitled to a quality education for their children from its public school system, a constitutional right, something which they had been denied. The federal court was literally, as Tom Atkins called it, the court of last resort. In the case of an absolutely defiant and intransigent school committee, after almost 9 years of protest, the founding of freedom schools, Black independent schools, Operation Exodus, METCO, and many other creative ways of gaining a better education for their beloved children, the somewhat reluctant plaintiffs agreed to file suit against the school committee. After years of warring with Louise Day Hicks, whom Noel Day, the executive director of St. Mark's Social Center, called the Sheriff Jim Clark of Boston, the parents would finally see their day in court. The trial took 2 years to decide. Few realized what was in store for Boston. And the rest, as they say, is history. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that important insight. And I assume people in this room know, but many watching may not know, that this fight is hundreds of years old. It does not start in the 1960s and 70s. So thank you for grounding us in that history. Before we move on to our fireside chat, I want to make mention that we have been joined by another panelist. Vernita Weller Carter is with us. Thank you so much. She is the daughter of Reverend Vernon Carter, and we will hear some of the stories that he has shared with her over the years. So thank you for being here so much. Ladies first. You did so much, and this was really important for me as a Black woman, Jean, when Lou first reached out to me about the committee and the work that was happening. I didn't want to have another conversation about busing or Judge Garrity. I wanted to have a conversation that would center Black women and the work that folks did to organize. There was a lot that happened before then. So I'm hoping that you will share some of your insights, Gene. What was it like? Why did you get involved? How did you get involved? And what lessons can we take from your experience and apply to today? I'm going to ask Zeb to pass them, because I'm not going to give up this mic. So we're going to get a mic down here. Thank you.
I have one lesson. And that is vote. Get everyone that you know.
Yes. You guys can clap.
Register to vote in whatever municipality in which you live. It is really serious that we use the franchise of being a citizen to use that franchise to help this country live with us on it, maybe for another half century, maybe. We're in trouble. I remember sitting in a bus with Ruth Batson going to the Heights. That's South Boston High School. And we were on the first bus that went up there. The principal of the high school was a wonderful man. They removed him and placed a younger person in it who really didn't know Southie and didn't have history with the school, so it didn't go as well as it should have gone. But the first principal who was present there had been removed and later taught a course on desegregation, which was excellent. But I can remember sitting with Ruth on that bus going up the boulevard, up to the hills where the South Boston High School is. And
Gene,
remember,
what made you get on that bus? Tell us what prompted
you. We wanted to protect the children. Mm-hmm. We were on the bus mm-hmm. with the children. Mm-hmm. It was Ruth's idea. Ruth and Ellen Jackson. We felt that if we as adults were there on the bus, that would make the families who trusted us know that if we put our lives on the line with their children, that it would be safe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was not just something that we thought up ourselves. We would totally get on that bus and ride with the children. Ellen and Ruth had done the groundwork for a long time before that. So it wasn't a surprise that Ruth Batson would be riding and sitting on the seat beside me. The interesting thing is when we got back home, we were coming up Washington Street from Dudley, and a little boy whose sister went to Lexington High. He went to Lexington. He had heard that busing was bad, and he threw a brick through the window where Ruth and I were sitting. It let me know that it ain't the bus, it's us. And that was my memory mostly was of that little boy who felt that busing was bad, and he was black. And we were coming back home. But I find that knowing Boston and loving the city in which I was born, that everything we do is worth it. Mm-hmm. Everything we do, no matter how little, is worth it. So if you do nothing else, get everybody you know, particularly the younger ones, to register to vote and make sure they get to the polls, because that is really important. I have friends now who don't think voting is important, who aren't registered to vote. I broke up with somebody because the kids weren't registered to vote. I said, no, freedom ain't free, and I'm not free.
Hey now, all right. Thank you. Thank you so much. And, you know, maybe we have to hang out after so I can hear more of that story. But for now, we're going to hear from Hubie. I'm going to ask you the same question, Hubie. If you could say why, how you got involved, and share any lessons.
I arrived here in 1955 to go to graduate school at Boston University School of Social Work. I saw Boston as up south, because everywhere I looked, there were patterns of racial discrimination in public housing, in the public school system, in the police department, in the fire department. When you went downtown to Jordan Marsh or Filene's, black people were not salespeople doing out front work. They were in the stock rooms or on the loading docks bringing in goods. And they were almost invisible as a presence in the city. So I saw this as an up south place, and something had to be done about it. As the civil rights movement in the South began to roll toward Boston, I went to see Mel King, the incredible South End black leader, and I suggested to him that it would be a good idea to launch a work stoppage, a one-day work stoppage, to get the attention of white leaders, business as well as civic leaders and political leaders, to know that they have been ignoring the grievances of black people for too long. Mm-hmm. And it had to stop. And he agreed with me that this might be a good idea. And he brought together some other people who thought it was a good idea. Some black leaders thought it was not a good idea. And we prevailed anyway because the idea took flight.
Yeah. And Hubie, is this one of the ideas that you presented to the Boston School Committee with Mel? Or were those separate proposals?
This was separate.
Oh, okay. Can you talk about the proposals to the school committee as well?
Sure. So anyway, that led to a work stoppage. Suffice it to say, thousands of people stayed out of work. Mm. We led a march down Columbus Avenue to the Boston Common to attend the memorial service for Medgar Evers, who had been assassinated in Mississippi. And we started out with 500 people, and by the time we got to the Boston Common, there were almost 1,000 people, okay? And the presence was felt, and the message was sent, okay? So I also was at the June 11th meeting at the school committee, where Ruth Batson and Paul Parks, co-chairs of the NAACP's Education Committee, laid out the case for the fact that the schools were de facto segregated. And they laid out a powerful case how things were unequal in the schools that black and white kids were going to. And that something had to be done. They laid out a 14-point set of demands that started with, you first have to acknowledge that there is at least de facto segregation. We are not charging you with de jure segregation, that you intentionally did that, but whether it was intentional or not, this condition had to be addressed. After Ruth Batson laid out her case, Louise Day Hicks, the chair of the school committee, said, Mrs. Batson, we do not segregate in the Boston public schools. We merely send kids to schools nearest their homes. So we reject your notion that we're involved in segregating the schools. And basically, we're not going to do anything. And of course, they were not going to do anything because they had promised their white constituents that if you stick with us, you won't have to worry about your kids going to school with black kids. That was the promise that was made, okay? And when we get further on, when we talk about the fact that Judge Garrity did what he did, they had broken their promise. And as a result of breaking their promise, none of them could get reelected to anything again. their constituents were through with them. And I would suggest to you that as a result of lancing this boil, this racist boil that was in the middle of Boston, it was lanced by this action, move the city in a more moderate direction. Okay? Now, people, when I said this in 1979 in speeches, people said, what are you talking about, Hubie? Are you crazy or something? They couldn't see it. But by the beginning of the 80s, when Mel King, with his Rainbow Coalition, became a viable candidate for mayor, everybody could see it, that we're now in a very different place.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you. Now, before we open it up, we do want to show some video clips. So this next clip is from WGBH, the recent documentary, and I think it will be cued on this back screen for the panelists who want to turn and look.
It was a very hot night. There was no air conditioning. The windows were wide open in search of air. You could hear downstairs demonstrators chanting and singing freedom songs. Inside the school committee headquarters, Ruth Batson presented her case to the all-white school committee.
Ruth Batson really is on a mission to get the Boston School Committee to admit that there was de facto segregation in the schools and to do something about it.
Louise Day Hicks, South Boston lawyer, chairperson of the school committee, said to Mrs. Batson, Mrs. Batson, we don't segregate the schools. We only assign students to schools closest to where they live. So we're not accepting this notion. And we are not going to do anything about what you're talking about.
We made our presentation and everything broke loose. We were completely rejected that night and we left battle scarred.
If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children best public school available, if he cannot vote, who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay?
So here you've got President Kennedy making an impassioned speech to the nation in this morally rich position that he's taking, juxtaposed with the Boston School Committee, which is presented with this opportunity, and it does exactly the opposite. Dug its heels in.
This meeting is a turning point. It ignited a movement. The civil rights movement came to Boston on June 11th, 1963.
So in this clip, we see Ruth Batson making her case to the Boston School Committee. And we are blessed to be here tonight with a panelist who worked very closely with Ruth during this time. And so I want to open it up to our panelists, and I'm going to start with Lida. Lida, if you could just share some reaction there. And again, if there are lessons that you want to impart with this audience, when we think about our schools today, we know that they're still segregated, and we know that the quality that parents were fighting for 50 years ago, they're still chasing that today. So if there are lessons you could share.
One of the lessons is I think I was very fortunate to have been with Ruth for 35 years. And I met her when I was only 22 years old as a Boston school teacher. So I knew from the inside what kids were, how they were treated and how badly they were treated and how black children and how how horrible their experiences were. So when I met her, she adopted me and brought me over to Metco. And one of the things that I learned quite firmly was that there are few people in the world with such a pointed direction in their lives. And I know that her direction was to help children get a better education, live a good life, to help parents feel whole, feel as if they have power to make their lives, their children's lives, change. I know that. And I also know that people who surrounded her adored her, primarily those of us who worked for her and worked with her, primarily because of her strength. And when you work with someone who has that kind of strength, they spread that strength. And that's where action comes from. That's the kind of thing that makes people know that they have a mission in life, and that mission belongs to someone else. It's for you to do something for other people. So Ruth's life was really a life of service. And I went with her for so many years wherever she went. I mean, I was like, take me with you. Of course I will. And off I would go with her. So she went from place to place where she was recruited to do different things. And the one story that I think is important for you to know, for many people to know in this audience, was that she was at Boston University in the Division of Psychiatry, that traditional look. What she did was she changed it, and she turned it inside out. So what we ended up doing and what she ended up doing was having the School of Medicine and the Division of Psychiatry be part of desegregation movement. She developed crisis intervention teams where we had psychiatrists and psychiatrists at the Boston the Clarendon YWCA, where kids from Charlestown, after they came from those horrible experiences, would go to the Clarendon YWCA. And psychiatrists and social workers would be there to talk to them. Who would have thought that? But that was also in conjunction, not just with Ruth, but with an active community, with an active Black community in Roxbury. So one of the messages that I have and that I often think about is how many people didn't understand how many people from Roxbury, from the larger area, was really a part of that movement of desegregation that was led by, as you would say, Black women, but also Black men. You had Hubie, you had Mel, you had people coming together for the sake of the children.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Before we open it up to other panelists, we have one more treat in terms of video clips. We're going to go to the second clip on Busing Battleground now.
We go prepared to the school system, and we were really innocent. We were naive. We were insulted. We were told our kids were stupid, and this is why they didn't learn. We found out that we had brought to them a wonderful political issue, and that this was an issue that was going to give their political career stability for a long time to come.
Boston witnessed the Stay Out for Freedom Day, the so-called boycott by Negro students of junior and senior high schools of Boston.
When the school committee refused to do anything to respond to the NAACP, the Black community decided that they had to keep the pressure on and act. Reverend James Breeden had witnessed a school stay out in the South, and he suggested doing the same thing in Boston. Let's get the Black children to stay out of school for a day and to show that we represent a lot of people.
When the Stay Out of School for Freedom came, there was no question I was going to be there. I was coming out of a relatively poor family, but even as a child, I had aspirations to do better. I didn't tell my parents. Dad would be scared that that could impact him.
We identified locations where we set up freedom schools, and we filled them with music, with poetry, and with lessons, and with speakers who these young people would never have an opportunity to encounter. We helped to make the connection to the South. We helped them to understand that this freedom school was part of the civil rights movement.
Most of you came here because you understood that here in Boston, you are deprived of your rights just as much as people in Birmingham are deprived of their rights. We've taken the first real step in Boston in beginning the struggle for our freedom here.
Bill Russell, the Boston Celtics shoe, gave a very powerful speech today at this Freedom Sit-In. Could you tell us what you feel is the success of this Freedom Stay Out?
The important thing is that we have taken the first step. And we have, as they say, thrown the gauntlet down, and we're into the fight now. And I think we'll win.
Wow, wow. Now, I remember my mom telling me a story of her going to a freedom school back when she was in high school. So she graduated high school in 1964. She went to this freedom school at St. Cyprian Church to hear Stokely Carmichael speak. I don't know if this we're going to get to this, but I want Charlie to jump in, Charlie, and talk to us about the Freedom School you coordinated as part of this 1963 Stay Out, because it's not like kids were home watching cartoons.
No.
We were still going to educate our children. Talk about that, Charlie.
No, my story is a story about teenagers. Teenagers from a small town in the South, educating and inspiring teenagers in Roxbury. And then teenagers in Roxbury educating and inspiring suburban teenagers. I ought to mention that the original steering committee for the first Freedom Stay Out Day included Jean McGuire, her mother, two other people, and me. But a little after that, a number of white ministers from the Boston area went to Williamston, North Carolina at the recommendation of Dr. King in order to support the flagging freedom movement there. And when we got there, we found that although there were one or two adults in leadership, like the great Sarah Small, who later moved to Boston, the energy and the zeal was on the part of the teenagers in that small North Carolina town. After we had been there a week and spent some time in jail, by the way, with the Williamston teenagers, they came to Boston at Christmas time, 1963. And I was able to persuade the youth group for my church, St. John's Roxbury Crossing, to attend the initial event at one of the churches on Columbus Avenue. I forget which one. The Boston teenagers were not really at that point very interested in the whole issue of what was going on in the South. They thought of that as being something very different. But that experience of hearing the teenagers from Williamston speak and testify about what freedom meant to them, what dignity meant to them, what respect meant to them, was absolutely galvanizing for our Roxbury teenagers. And so when a few months later we organized the Freedom School at St. Cyprian's, in Roxbury, I decided that all of the teaching would be done by teenagers. I was the only adult who had any role there, and I didn't do anything except keep the schedule. There were three or four other adults who prepared lunch. But all of the teaching, all of the small group leadership was done by teenagers from Roxbury. And we had about 400 youth there. 200 of them were from the Boston schools. 200 were from suburban schools who had been bused in by their school systems as volunteers. And if you look at the picture, there's one on the table down there of the St. Cyprian's Freedom School. You won't see any adults. You'll see our Freedom Choir leading the other 400 youth in a whole day's worth of peaceful, engaged, exciting discussion about what it meant to be a dignified and respected and free human being. I don't think we had Stokely Carmichael, as far as I can recall. The leadership was those kids. And the one assignment that I gave to all of them was that each of them had to write about what that day had meant to them, and specifically what freedom meant to them. And mind you, they weren't talking about what we call civil rights. They weren't talking about laws. They weren't talking about that kind of thing. They were talking about the dignity of standing up as a human being and the way in which they saw that reflected in the bravery of the youth they had heard from North Carolina and which in turn they intended to express in their own lives, and many of them did. So I urge you to look at the essays that are there on the table, a number of them. I have all of them here, actually. They're exciting, and they're the voices of teenagers 60 years ago trying to come to terms with what it was to be a free man or woman.
Thank you so much, Reverend Charlie. Thank you. Now, Gloria, you were 12 years old, right, during this time? I'd love for you to share as one of those young people.
Okay. Good evening. My name is Gloria Bourne Lee. I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and attended the Cambridge Public Schools. And as a child and a teenager, I was a member of the historic Union Baptist Church in Cambridge. And one day, our youth leaders said to us, we're going into Boston. We're going to learn about some things that have been happening in Boston with the schools and with the children. And so we thought that was a pretty good idea. And so we got on the bus, went to Dudley Station, and walked up the hill to 12th Baptist. Now, I was familiar with 12th Baptist. My family had migrated from the South in 1940, and so I had been to the church. And I walked in, and I don't know what we did there, but I know how I felt. Mm-hmm. I felt at home. I felt comfortable. I saw boys and girls who looked like me. I saw teachers, church leaders who had smiles on their faces. I know we sang together. We learned about what was happening in Boston and what was happening to my cousins who lived in Boston. And we got a certificate when we left, which I saw on the table down there. So we felt as though we had done something. We felt as though we had done something good. Sometimes we can't remember where we went, but we remember the feeling. It was a congenial feeling. I felt as though we had accomplished something and that the people who brought us there were friendly to us. And I remember, like I said, the feelings of, and I don't remember whether we returned again for the second one or not. I'm sorry, I can't remember that long ago. But what did all this do for me? I wanted to work with children. I had a desire to work with children. In the summertime, I had worked with children in Cambridge. So it kind of re-energized my desire to work with young people and children, and I knew that I could make a difference in their lives. And when I finished my teacher prep, the cooperating principal and the cooperating teacher said to me, how would you like to work at an independent school in Roxbury? And I said, sure. So I ended up at the New School for Children in Roxbury, the 71-72 school year. It was my first position. It was a well-run school. It was run by the parents, the principal, and they had a model called the open classroom. If you're not familiar with that, it's putting K-1 and 2 children in the same room, and you could grow and progress at your own rate. And that was a model that I kept, that K-1-2. I went on from there. I went to graduate school. When I returned to Boston in 1975, I became a member of the Medco staff. I was the placement counselor, and I tested the kids who applied for Medco. And as I moved through my teaching years in New Jersey and Massachusetts, I remembered what it was like to be at 12th Baptist Church. And I used some of the models of the open classroom as I went through. And I remember that the experiences and the feelings that I had at Freedom Stay Out Day and as a teacher at the New School for Children stayed with me. And I even have a picture of my class. That's my students there. And their names are underneath there. So if you were around in 71, 72, then you may have been my class and I may have been your teacher. Yeah, okay. And I made a copy for the table down there. And thank you so much. I was a cog in a big wheel. And I'd like to thank all the people in Boston who worked hard for the children of Boston. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Gloria. This is me.
That's you?
Oh, my God. She was my teacher. This is
me. Did you bring your lunch?
You were her teacher.
Oh. I thought my teacher was Miss Eastman, though.
No, it was Mrs. Bourne, Miss Bourne.
Gloria
Bourne.
And Gregory.
Gregory York was the assistant teacher.
Yeah. I was there 2 years, though, so Gloria, Miss Eastman was my teacher, I think, another year.
Okay.
Wow. Wow. You guys are going to have to see this picture. Thank you so much. And I don't want to eat up the time, so we're going to get right back to... That's me with that big afro. Yes, that's me. Okay, we're gonna save the picture for after. We have this wonderful display here of all these pictures. We've got one more panelist. And the good news here, if we keep our remarks brief, we're going to open it up to the audience. So I do want to hear from, we all want to hear from Vernita, who is going to talk about, I hope, her father's, was it 114 days? He had 114 consecutive days of picketing the Boston School Committee headquarters.
Yep.
Tell us about those stories. And if you could lift up lessons that your dad imparted on you for all of us, that would be great.
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me. This was a very unexpected surprise. So I'm just thrilled to be here and just to give a glimpse back in the time and in the moment in which this all came to fruition for my father. So I'm actually wanting to read an excerpt from his personal manifesto, the third and final Emancipation. And if you want to know more about that, please see me after. But I'd love to just read this to you. First of all, I'm living in Vermont right now. I am an instructor to first-year students as part of a success program that's recently been started, St. Michael's College in Colchester, Vermont. And basically, my father passed in 2007 and came to live with us in Vermont, which it was very hard to get him to come to Vermont. He did not want to leave Boston under any circumstances. But he was pastor of All Saints Lutheran Church in the south end of Boston from 1955 to 1979. Although I could retell the account of his 114-day vigil, it would be much more meaningful for you to hear his account in his own words. So below, I'm going to read this excerpt from the third and final Emancipation. 9 a.m., I appeared alone at 15 Beacon Street with the sign, "I will demonstrate until the Boston School Committee takes action on racial imbalance in Boston public schools. Will you join us?" Little did I realize that the small space I was walking would be my home for 114 days and 5 hours. The Freedom Vigil was on. It was my vigil, because it had to be, and was like the song, "Don't you let nobody turn you around, don't you let nobody turn you around." Many times they called it Vernon Carter's vigil. I took no offense. I had come from behind the stained glass windows of my church and took on the winds and rain, the day and the night. The first day, the airwaves announced that a lonely minister of color was picketing the school committee, vowing to stay there until action is taken on racial imbalance. All day, the news media announced my presence at 15 Beacon Street. The morning passed with curious passerbys. The afternoon passed. I was still walking alone. At 9 p.m., a young school teacher, a white school teacher named Nineen Gowdy of the Billericay Public School System, came up to me and said, "I am here to walk with you." I smiled and said, "Thank you." Now it was 2. I had been walking nonstop for 12 hours. It was dark that night. Still, only 2 were walking. The street was quiet, a few cars passing, their occupants glancing with me with more curiosity. We heard Park Street Congregational Church clock strike 12 times. It was midnight. By 2 o'clock in the morning, my school teacher and I were still walking nonstop. And suddenly, and to our surprise, out of the dark appeared 50 people from the Congress on Racial Equality, walking in quietly and taking their place in back of us. This was the defining moment that capstoned the reality of the Freedom Vigil of 1965 in Boston and caught hold of the coattails of the civil rights movement of America. This was my answer to those who were discouraged, disheartened, and disappointed. There's so much more to this story, and I wish I had time to tell you. But during those days, he was shot at, screamed at, assaulted, and reviled. At the same time, newspapers and news sources from not only Boston, but all across the country recorded thousands of people who came to walk with him, pray with him. In fact, it was a conference with one of the Unitarian Universalist churches that brought 1,000 members down to walk with my father. A little Volkswagen bus was provided for him to sleep in, as well as engage in meetings with a phone that was installed in the vehicle, attached to the Boston School Committee, no less. On August 18, 1965, Governor Volk signed the Racial Imbalance Act into law. And later that afternoon, my father ended his vigil of 114 days and 5 hours. He was present at the signing at which Governor Volk gifted my father with the first signing pen.
That was wonderful. That was wonderful.
You'll have to buy the book in order to hear the rest of the story.
Do you have a book?
In the process of writing a book. Good. And there's so much material. And I know that Phyllis Ryan, who was a press secretary in those days, is not with us anymore. But if it wasn't for her, I would not have the amount of material that I have. She archived all of her works at Northeastern University. Wow. And that material is now, has just been gifted to me and made available to me. And I want to thank James Vrabel, because he was the one, when I got his book, and he wrote an excerpt of the story, which I couldn't find anywhere on my father. In fact, he's been pretty obscure in the messaging and the history of his part in the civil rights movement of Boston. And I am here to make sure that his story gets told. I promise
yes.
that.
Yes. Thank you, Vernita.
I promise that.
We need to tell all of these stories.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Would you all please give it up for this wonderful panel? Would you also please give it up for our timekeepers. Give it up for our timekeepers. This is why we can take some questions. Now, we have a microphone that is right here. And one, I think there's one right here. If people want to line up, if you're not able, we can try to move the mic. If you can't get to it, are there questions from the audience? I can't see. Are there questions? Okay.
I'm Karis McLaughlin, and I worked with Jean for many years.
Yes.
As president of her board. Her board. And I guess, you know, the history is wonderful. I mean, we have such a rich history in Massachusetts. And so my question is, I'm looking at what's happening today. And we are now living in a world where we have one man who, his name is Klum, who is willing to take away every civil right that I have. And so when I think of the knowledge that's at that table and within this room, what are we going to do for the children so that they have a decent story to tell? Because right now they don't. Boston is not where it needs to be. Metco needs to be stronger.
Thank you.
We have to take the time and work together to ensure that the next generation is not in slavery. Because as I look at what's happening today, and I don't know about the rest of you all, but I'm afraid. Because Klum is getting ready to sue little Rudy from the Cosby family because she gives $20,000 a year to black females.
So, Karis, I think we've got the question. Oh. What are we going to do? Thank you so much. I want to open it up to the panel, whoever wants to take that. I do want to make sure, and it's an important question, and I think many of us feel that fear that you're talking about, but I want to make sure if we can get other questions. If you do have other questions, please just line up to the mics now so we can get a sense of how many questions. But I want to open it up. Who wants to take this first question? What are we going to do? Zeb.
Well, you know, it was mentioned that we need to vote. And it does recall today's climate. You know, a lot of people say, why did busing have to happen? Why did that court order have to be so severe? No one is above the law. And the Boston School Committee just ignored the racial imbalance law that your father helped to bring about from Massachusetts SCLC. They just ignored state law and did what they wanted to do. So the slap, it couldn't just be a slap on the wrist. When you ignore the law, some people running for president today, no one is above the law. So, yeah, we have to vote, as this esteemed lady just said earlier on. And we also have to follow the footpaths of the people who came before that said a city in which black people couldn't buy a house in Charlestown, South Boston, West Roxbury back then. You couldn't even go there or be there at certain times at night. Boston's a much more open city today. And it's
because of the people. And yet we still have many of the same challenges, though.
Yes, we do. That's right.
But we are grateful for the progress we've made. We've got a couple of educators. I want to see if Gloria or Lida want to jump in before we get to you, Charlie. Do you guys want to jump in on that?
Nope.
Okay, go ahead, Charlie.
I just want to correct that last remark, because the state racial imbalance law was not useless. In fact, the Supreme Judicial Court had ordered Boston to implement the plan that was implemented in September 1974, and it would have been implemented even if Judge Garrity had not come along. Now, the advantage of Judge Garrity coming along was that he was able to order a lot more elements that were beyond what the state could order under the racial imbalance law. But it is not the case that the school committee could have gone on ignoring the racial imbalance law. The work of Vernon Carter and others was not in vain, and in fact, it had reached its culmination in 74.
Charlie, we're going to let Zeb Lida respond.
Yeah. So this is going to be really quick because this is a little bit of what we should already know. But what Garrity did, the one thing that I do remember Ruth getting so angry about was this blame on a judge. When in effect, that was the Brown decision. And the Brown decision had two parts. One was no longer separate but equal. And the second one, part of it was, part two, with all deliberate speed. That was the law. And what angers me so much is, and this still does today, is this use of busing as a word that captures something that doesn't exist. Those are wheels, and they're transportation to and from. And the buses actually, historically, took children past good schools to poor schools. So busing really was taken on by people who did not want to sit next to kids who were not the same race as they were. That's deep. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It's not an easy fix to say, we need to get rid of busing. We need to get rid of racism. We need to start to learn how to live with each other. But that's easier said than done, mm-hmm. because each one of us has to have a commitment to call it what it is. And that is, I'm with you, vote right.
Yes.
Yeah. Vote right.
Yes, yes. We've got another question for the audience. I know Jean wants to jump in, but before we do, I want to make sure this young person has a chance to ask a question. And this is probably the last question because we want to wrap up at 7:30 on time. I don't think we can hear you.
Hello, I'm Eli. And I kind of had a question about I'm a senior in high school currently, and I've been through like a lot of lockdown drills throughout my time in middle school and high school, and I've luckily not in my school, but I've heard of some of my friends who have like police in their school to help defend from like shooters and stuff. And what do you think about stuff like that? Sort of, because you guys all are so passionate about education, and it's amazing.
So
I go to Boston University Academy.
Yeah, so the question was around this feeling of being safe. So Karis opened us up with feelings of fear, and we're closing out around school safety. If any panelist wants to address that, I do want to give the mic over to Jean. Do you want to talk about that? And then I want you to close out on the point that we were talking about earlier. That's your mic.
Mel King said, it ain't the bus, it's us.
That's right.
Don't use that word. Everybody in suburban schools, except the ones who live around the corner, rides to school on a bus. I rode a bus to go to school in Stoughton and Canton. Don't use the word busing as a cover for all the things that are wrong in America and need to be righted by you.
I agree.
And that means vote. Seriously. If there's anything... If we could have had Trump for president, anybody can be president. Anybody. So run for office. Get your friends to run for office and help people who are running for office in any way you can. Put a sign on your front porch or wherever you live or on your car. Talk about it. Pass out flyers with friends. But use democracy and the freedom you have to get out the word. Vote.
So thank you so much. Thank you. Eli, where are you, Eli? Eli, how old are you? So do you live in Boston, Eli? Okay, wonderful. You can register to vote now, and you'll be eligible when you turn 18 to actually vote. If you care about school safety, if you care about the quality of education, it is important that you make sure that you're exercising your right to vote. And I'm so glad that you're here. and that you're using your voice to raise up those issues. Let's give it up for Eli. Yes, everyone who is 16. Jean is pointing out, anyone who is 16, you can register. You can pre-register
in school
or libraries or at the elections department, at the registry, wherever you want. But please register and vote. One more time for this amazing panel. You know, I was really interested in hearing the stories and listening for the lessons, and the discussion was really so rich. And so I want to, one, highlight what Jean said, which is to vote. So one lesson, what do we do? One solution we have is to vote, to make sure that we are really exercising that power. But before we can even know what to vote on or what we're voting for or against, we've got to acknowledge the problem. I heard one of the panelists, I think it was you, Lida, who talked about the importance when we were looking at Ruth Batson. She was making the case. She had to state what the problem was and a potential solution. So that was really important. I heard panelists talk about the importance of mission and being driven and talking about a life of service. I want to lift up some of what Reverend Charlie talked about in centering young people, which is why I'm so glad we could end with you, Eli. He talked about young people inspiring other young people actually teaching in the classrooms and inspiring other folks, and the connections that young people found with each other, even though they had very, very different lived experience, whether we were talking about the North and the South. We heard the importance of feeling safe and feeling like we're home. Gloria talked about that. Every child in our schools should feel like school is a safe place, a safe haven. Many of our kids in Boston, anyway, that is their only option. Coming to and from school can be a danger zone. What is happening in the home might be problematic. So we do need to make sure that we are wrapping our arms around our children and providing that safety. We talked about learning about new models and implementing those models. So Gloria pointed out the open classroom model at New School for Children and how she applied that when she taught in other districts. We talked about dignity and humanity and centering people's humanity. And then I want to end with the powerful story that we heard about Reverend Carter. And the lesson that really stood out for me is it takes one. He was out there by himself for I don't know how long. It takes one person to step up and take action.
And start a movement.
So exactly. Just do something. Do something. Once again, please give it up for this wonderful panel. And I want to invite Lou. You guys can do better than that. Give it up for this panel. Give it up for Lou Finfer. Give it up for Carolyn Crockett. Where are you, Carolyn? Where are you, Carolyn? I don't see Carolyn. Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you. This has been an honor and a pleasure, and I can't wait for the other events in the series. Thank you so much, Lou.
Okay, sorry. Technical difficulties like we had with the Zoom. I'm Lou Finfer with the Boston Desegregation and Busing Initiative, with co-chairing with Carolyn Crockett. Could all the members from the committee raise your hand who are here with us tonight? Because you're the people who worked to put this together. This is a night to remember what the panelists shared: Jean McGuire, UB Jones, Zeb Maletsky, Lida Peters, Gloria Lee, Charlie Glenn, and Bernita Carter Weller. We're going to remember what they said tonight. I'd also like to thank our moderator, Mayor Kim Janey. Let's give it up for Kim. Thank our hosts at Roxbury Community College, Jackie Jenkins, Scott, Marta Rosa, Shanira Lindsay, Nellie Poulters. We want to thank our partners at GBH, Barra Levin, Sandra Lopez Burke, and Juan Jose Duenas. We want to thank Mass Historical Society, Olivia Seya. We've thanked our committee. We want to thank the art. Much of this stuff comes from the archives at Northeastern. Especially Molly Brown is here from the Archives of Northeastern, the wonderful Molly Brown, who brought these photos and documents to us, and also from UMass Boston, and also the essays that Charlie talked about. There's about 60 of them. The essays on freedom that Charlie talked about are on the table in two piles. What's next in next year? We're going to do a forum in June on June 20th, 2024, at the federal courthouse, examining how did the court case get filed, the trial, the decision, the ramifications, and some of the what-ifs in that momentous thing. In the fall of 2024, we're going to have an all-day town meeting. In the morning, we're going to talk about what happened in the schools and in the neighborhoods when busing started. And in the afternoon, we're going to talk about the lessons, the legacy of desegregation and busing. Was it a success or was it a failure? And we're going to also do a forum on the suburban resistance to integration and what METCO's been trying to do about that. There's more exhibitions and photos and documents down here. We're also working to support Facing History and Ourselves in the Boston Public Schools in teaching this history to Boston Public School students, which will be, they'll be training this spring of teachers and teaching in the fall of 74. Is that what we need? But our theme of this is what happened, lessons learned, and what next. So we are going to humbly try to walk with yourselves and other people in the city, both to support the superintendent and the mayor and the Boston Public Schools, but also to push when they need pushing, and they still need some pushing to get there. So that's what we're going to do. Okay. You'll also be able to look at the whole the Busing Battleground documentary. We have one of the heroic filmmakers, Sharon Grimberg, who's here. Sharon, are you still here? Sharon's over there, one of the filmmakers, along with Cindy Reason. You can watch it online at American Experience, and you'll see several of the people you saw tonight, as well as others, are in that. There's refreshments in the lobby, and you can look at these historic documents. And five forums is not enough. There's so many ideas for more forums, more exhibits, more action to improve education, and with your help and involvement, we'll try to do it. Thanks very much for being here.